Welcome, everyone. Very happy to be here. I'm Eric Davis, as he said. I've written some books. I'll have a few of them on sale later. I'm very happy today. I launched the new version of my website, which has been a long time coming. So I've been going through all of my stuff and thinking about where I've been and why I'm doing what I'm doing. And a lot of that has to do with what I'm going to be talking about tonight. And just to give you a little sense of the overall goal is that I know we're full of a lot of very knowledgeable, opinionated, interesting, talkative people, and I, in many ways, I'm just sort of priming the discussion. So I'll aim for about 45 minutes, and what my goal is to try to lay out a map, almost a topographical map, of what we could call psychedelic culture, although I think that's not really the right word, partly because there are so many cultures now under that umbrella with the psychedelic renaissance, the transformations in science, in psychology, in the underground, in ayahuasca culture. There's just so many things going on that it's even the idea of there being a culture or a sort of psychedelic scene, I think, is no longer appropriate. So what I'm going to try to do is sort of lay out a map more of what I'll call discourse, which is a sort of fancy, obnoxious word in some ways, but is very helpful. And what I mean by it is that the language we use, the ideas we bring, the metaphors we bring about what things are, have a direct impact on the nature of the thing we're doing, particularly on the nature of experience. And we all know this already, because for all the change and transformation and ups and downs and decades and crazy characters and visions and busts and everything that has constituted the history of psychedelics in the West for the last 50-odd years, there has been one incredibly consistent and continually rewarding idea from the current protocols that scientists use in their experiments to back to the early 60s. What is that? What's that principle?
The microphone.
Oh, I gotta eat it?
No.
Oh, sorry, kids.
Sound.
Hello, okay. Sorry about that. How did that go off? Anyway, do I need to repeat myself?
Yes.
Sorry about that. Annoying. Yeah. So what I want to do tonight is lay out a map, a topography of psychedelic culture at the crossroads, at this point when there's so many different things going on in the renaissance of psychedelic research and in the continual transformations and changes inside of... It's still not good, huh? Oh, you know what? It's going off on its own. It's actually, there's a problem with the mic. Okay. That ain't my fault. Oh my God. Okay. Well, here's what I'm going to do. I am going to project. I can project, and I'm going to do so. So, I'm going to walk, though. It'll make it easier. Tonight, I'm going to lay out a map. A complex, actually it only has four parts of this map of psychedelic space. Psychedelic, and it's got four areas: the underground, the gray market, the clinic, and the jungle. And again, what I'm going to be laying out is not so much a culture as discourse, the language we use, the images, the dominant metaphors. And the reason these are particularly important, this idea of discourse shaping our experience, which I think is true across the board, is particularly important in psychedelics, despite the fact that psychedelic experience is often ineffable, i.e. not really capturable by language. Nonetheless, we're still here speaking monkeys, and we need to use our language to do that. Now, this goes back to, again, what's the most consistent principle in psychedelic experience and psychedelic research since the early 60s? Set and setting, exactly. Well, what is set and setting? Okay, sure, my mindset and the environment that I'm in help produce, constitutes, set up my experiences in a with a different set, different setting, different things are going to go on. Well, what is set? It's not just your attitude, positive, negative, sad, happy. Set is also your language, your images, your ideas. What? Thank you very much. Okay. So what is your set? It's not just your emotions that day, or whether you're excited or depressed. It's your ideas, your images, the metaphors that you use to understand what your experiences are. And so as I go through these different domains, part of what I'm talking about are these different fundamental metaphors and ideas. What are psychedelics? What are they? What is LSD? I mean, within the first 30 years of its adventure in modern culture, LSD was, you know, a truth serum, used as a brain modification, mystical states, a modeler of psychosis, a revolutionary compound, an anti-modernist compound. It goes on and on and on, this one little molecule. And these metaphors that we use construct the experience. So with that in mind, I'll begin with the underground. This is the topic of my current research project, my dissertation project. It's called High Weirdness, Drugs, Media, and Gnosis in the Early 70s. And I'm really focusing on a particular strand, not just of psychedelic culture, but kind of counterculture in general. But it's one that is perhaps best represented by a comment that Art Kleps makes in the late 60s. He of the Boohoo Bible, one of these characters who mixes religious imagery with some underground political thinking. And he talks about, he's writing about gurus and the popularity of gurus in the late 60s. And he says, you know, these guys are okay, you know, whatever, but I'm more interested in a different tradition, a tradition that he considers a Western tradition, one that marries mystical and visionary experience to the vocal support of human liberty and political radicalism in all sorts. And that's really what I think is interesting about this space, is that there's a kind of radicalism in the very experiential domain of the compounds themselves. What does that mean? It's that we don't know what's going on. We don't know what the nature of reality is. We don't know what the gods are. There can be profound, deeply religious experiences. You become one with Jesus. You're Christ on the cross. And then afterwards, what am I going to do with that? Am I a Christian? What does that mean? There's this kind of existential process of inquiry that is a very important strand of the counterculture, because it's so easy to sort of generalize about what do we mean about the counterculture. You know, what are we thinking about? Is it the communalism? Is it the political radicalism? Is it the hippie ideology? Is it, you know, psychedelic music? You know, nasty feedback guitars? There's so many elements of the counterculture, and that what we need to think about now, and the reason I think this is important, is because in some ways, at least in terms of the meaning of psychedelics, the counterculture has kind of had its day. That even though the counterculture per se, depending on how you define it, goes on and continues to mutate, in a lot of ways, the discourse of psychedelics is changing fundamentally. And I think one of the questions we need to ask is, what is it that is valuable from this period to bring forward? And I say that because one of the dominant stories that's rising now with the Renaissance in psychedelic research is that, you know, psychedelics were being researched by scientists, and then it leaked out of the lab, and all the rabble got a hold of them, and then they became scheduled in the mid to late 60s. And from that point till today, or, you know, 5 years ago, 8 years ago, depending on what study you want to point to, maybe Strassman's work, until today, basically nothing happened. And all of that can be ignored. And there's a couple of problems with that. One, on the scientific tip, it implies that during that period of time, no science happened. This is absurd, because along with all the psychedelic freaks creating their vision, starting little cults, doing zines and comic books and making rock records and having orgies and all the crazy stuff people did in the underground, in the counterculture. There were people who were interested in botany, in protocols, in synthesis, in research, historical research, political research, in gathering and amassing an amount of information, a multidimensional kaleidoscopic field of information around these substances. This wasn't the dominant trend. This wasn't what, you know, all the deadheads on, you know, blotter at whatever, you know, Red Rock 77 were thinking about. But it is a very important strand that gets very quickly swept under the carpet as, for understandable reasons, people both inside of the emerging psychedelic science movement and people on the outside who have for decades been yearning for greater recognition, for serious study to be put on this, and especially for the loosening of the regulation and the scheduling order to let go and let these things move out into society. So there's an understandable exuberance for this moment of psychedelic renaissance. But the thing is that every kind of discursive shift comes at a cost. And that happens partly because every metaphor, every system of language comes along with its own sort of packages. You know, it's a package deal language. You can think about it in terms of entailments. If I'm a scientist in a laboratory, I'm treating the person who's coming into my psychological experiment as an object. It's an object of study, and I'm extracting data from that person. And that is going to structure my fundamental relationship and how I organize that. That might be a great idea. That might be just what needs to happen. But it also comes along with entailments that I have to acknowledge. And at the same time, as new discourses come up, new kinds of ways of describing things as a emerging culture of scientific and psychological, psychotherapeutic language emerges as a dominant way of talking about psychedelics, in order to define themselves, in order to give themselves power, they have to define themselves against something else, particularly what came before. So one of the things you're seeing now is that this question of, like, what is the legacy of the counterculture? What do we do with all these crazy guys? With Tim Leary and John Lilly and Robert Anton Wilson and, you know, Marsha Moore and all these fringe, experimental, courageous, poetic, you know, psychonauts. And so that's one of the reasons I'm really interested in kind of laying out this this topography. Another aspect of the sort of you know, freak scene that I think is really important to emphasize is that because psychedelic discourse was not part of the academy in all this time, wasn't part of psychology departments, wasn't part of history departments, wasn't part of literary departments, with a few exceptions, what it meant is that all of that discourse got pushed off into the non-academic, into the esoteric, the weird, the underground, the chaotic, the noisy, the trashy, and that it became, for that reason, incredibly mixed. So that if you went to a psychedelic conference in the 1980s, even into the 1990s, you would find this tremendous range of perspectives. So you'd have people who were hardcore scientists who knew their stuff inside or out. Some of them had degrees, some of them didn't. They were hanging out. And then right next to them, loonies talking about quantum physics and, you know, elves jumping out of the rooms and these, you know, mysteries that they've been revealed to, and they're looking for followers, they're trying to be gurus, and then everything in between, all manner of, you know, sardonic, humorous, hedonistic, libertarian, mythographers, historians, poets. And that richness, that kaleidoscopic language, existed partly because the whole thing was outside of the realm of the academy. Because what the academy does is it divides up, it creates hierarchies of status, who gets to talk about what, in what kind of manner, and everybody who has some investment in their position is very aware of what they can and what they cannot say. So it has a greatly different effect on the languages and our own ability to draw our own connections between very different kinds of domains. And personally, that was why I really got into the kind of psychedelic scene around 1999, 2000. I had already been interested in these things and I'd read about them, I had my experiences. But what really drew me to it was that it was an alternate zone of thinking, one that did not recognize the usual distinctions that organize public discourse inside mainstream society, whether it's on the mainstream that we see on the news or the New York Times or in the academy, where these very strong divides, particularly the divide between science and humanities or between nature and culture. And it seemed to me that psychedelics fundamentally challenged that divide. On the one hand, they can produce the most extraordinary experiences that resonate across history, poetry, religion, occultism, psychology. This rich domain of human experiences is brought to bear by these compounds that, at the same time, are material molecules that are produced through material means. They're traded as commodities. They're investigated as scientific objects, that they exist as material objects, agents almost, in the world. So it's a remarkable place not only to understand how these different domains of reality fit together, but also to investigate what does matter mean? What does it mean to have these kinds of material things that can invite and evoke so much? And that's, again, that multidimensionality, that kind of kaleidoscopic view that you can see, for example, in something like Dale Pendle's Pharmacopoeia series, which I highly recommend. I think it's a marvelous, excellent work of literature as well as psychedelic thought. And for those of you who are not familiar with Dale's work, what he does in those books is to use different kinds of writing, different kinds of language to approach the ally. He uses poetry, history, psychopharmacology, literature, imagery, anthropology, ethnography, and he writes in these different voices, and you start to realize that what we're talking about, because we can never talk about it perfectly, what we're talking about is something that is necessarily seen from multiple dimensions. And as we move outside of this domain into the mainstream, into legitimation, into authority, into institutions, that richness becomes challenged, begins to change in ways that I'm not saying we have to hold on to, but that we should be aware of the shift. So that, I think, will do for now for the underground. There's a lot more to say, but I really just want to lay the stuff out here and then get to some final comments and questions. So the second domain is the black market. Now, of course, the black market was intimately, or the gray market. Of course, the black market was totally involved with the counterculture, and indeed, part of the ethos, intellectual, spiritual, emotional, of the counterculture did come from the fact that it was illegal. And though, for a zillion reasons I don't need to list, there is a profound desire for that regime to disappear, it's also wrong of us to not acknowledge the positive factors that come of that. And, you know, to live outside the law, you must be honest, is only the beginning of the story. Then we get into this kind of gray market, or let's call it the drug nerd approach. And here, if Terence McKenna, for example, was an example of the underground, of someone who was born and raised in the hippie years, came of bizarre mind in the 1970s, and then sort of serves as a transfer point in the early 90s into a younger generation of psychonauts and countercultural people, bringing these memes and, you know, giving them a kind of digital remix, then the character who would represent the sort of gray market drug nerd zone is, of course, Alexander Shulgin, who, you know, recently passed away. And what Shulgin did is he created a space that was driven by science, by a certain kind of experimental rather than theoretical science, where he was literally exploring the possibility, the phase space of these compounds. Let's just see what happens when we treat them like tinker toys, and then very, you know, softly begin to take on and have a relationship with them. Well, in his wake, what you get is a kind of culture of tinkering, a culture of fascination with novelty and with the possibilities of synthesis. So when I first got involved in the scene in 2000, there was already a noticeable sort of subgroup or a separate kind of vibe of drug nerds who were interested in, you know, they were, you know, they lived on Arrowhead. They were interested in rigorously keeping track of their own experiences, in geeking out on all the details and possibilities, and of creating a kind of culture of novelty and experiment that was still outside of institutional science. It was still flying blind in many ways. It took on tremendous risks. But it didn't, the discourse, again, didn't really necessarily have the sort of resonance and richness and kind of patchouli oil excess of the countercultural lore that in some ways, in many ways, it was sort of differentiating itself from, even while taking part of it. You know, obviously Leary plays as much a role in that as he does in the former. All these zones are mixed together, but I think that it's also important to distinguish them. So what happens with the gray market? Well, the gray market, unlike the counterculture in many ways, gets taken up it's just perfectly designed for the emergence of our bizarre contemporary, whatever we call it, intertwingled digital reality, where global markets, the internet, and a sort of culture of novelty, a kind of maker culture of tinkering, moves into consciousness space, and we get what some people call consciousness hacking, which is the idea that the same consciousness tricks that a countercultural person might have thought would lead them into nirvana, give them the kind of wisdom that the Buddha talked about, now it becomes sort of a problem to hack. How can we make that happen? How can we use electronics and drugs to produce these effects, whatever we might want to do with them? And that begins to feed back with the explosion of information, the easy availability of these materials, and the willingness of global actors to produce anything you want and send it, because the doses are so small, you just put it in an envelope, nobody's going to see, and there's no way to stop that. Once that's out of the bag, there's no way to stop that. You have this incredible positive feedback loop of new data, experiments, an underground market, and tremendous demand. And it's not coincidental that electronic dance music also went mainstream over the last, what do you recall, 5 to 8 years. Because that is part of the same logic. It carries the same kind of global, digitally informed, highly networked, highly mobile characteristic to it. And so that all of these different domains, again, begin to feed off each other and create a very different phenomenon, something that's still underground in some ways, that's still countercultural in some ways, but it's very different, I believe, in a lot of ways than the counterculture that came before. And it very much impacts this kind of space that we're talking about, creating some interesting tensions. The third space is the space of the clinic. And some of the things I'll talk about here, you can read more about. I wrote an article for Arrowhead Extracts about 2 years ago. That's called the Multidisciplinary Associations of Psychedelic Discourse. And it's kind of a play and a dance with maps. And this is available on my website, technosis.com, and you can also get it on Arrowhead. And what I was interested in there is looking at how the shift to legitimacy from the underground and even the gray market to the clinic begins to really obviously show some of these dynamics I'm talking about. Shifts in discourse, what academics call strategies of othering. That means taking things that are actually really closely related and clearly distinguishing yourself from them as a way to clear out a space to define a new environment, an environment that's not tainted by smelly hippies, that's not tainted by crazy, you know, EDM fanatics who are taking white powders they don't know, even know what they are, from people who don't even know what they are. And so, that you know, it is completely understandable that as a psychedelic researcher, you would want to, as a psychedelic scientist, distinguish yourself from that world. But that too, those processes have consequences. And we need to be aware of those consequences and think about them. I think probably most of the people here have read Michael Pollan's article in The New Yorker, which for me is really a game changer. There were already positive articles about psychedelics in the New York Times Magazine, which historically has hated psychedelics, you know, and that's been coming the last few years. We've seen, we could all see this kind of sea change coming, and part of the reason it's coming is just simply, well, science. It's pretty clear that if you look at these things more or less objectively, they're going to show positive effects that at a certain point you can't really keep in the bag anymore. And if we're going to be a rational society as much as we can, a scientific society as much as we can, then we're going to have to take that stuff seriously. Michael Pollan's article, I think, was a brilliant work of creating a space that acknowledged the concerns, that acknowledged the need for care, for caution, but was really quite cleverly and in some ways rather subtly making a very strong case, not just for the legitimacy of psychedelic science, but for the deeper legitimacy of psychedelics in human experience, in human life. There was one interesting part at the end of the article that I want to read, if I can pull it up on my device here, that I want to show because it shows that even how this very careful author, who's very much on the right side, who's aware of the complexities, but is making the case for the legitimacy of these as medicines, performs his own kind of interesting othering. And this is when he's talking with Catherine McLean, who herself is a very interesting character because she works with Roland Griffiths in the lab that comes up with the, you know, groundbreaking 2006 study that said something that, if you knew the lore, we already knew from the 1960s, but it did it in an excellent way, that psilocybin can create something like mystical experiences, whatever mystical experiences exactly are. That's another question I'm going to hold off on just for a moment. But Catherine works for the lab, but in her own life, she kind of stepped away from research, and now she's moving in kind of a different direction. And it's interesting because she's sort of the only female voice in the article, and what she sort of talks from, the kind of place that she gets to inhabit, is a bridge between the scientists, most of whom, you know, most of the people he's talking about are male scientists, and a kind of more open zone. She talks about how she hopes someday to establish a psychedelic hospice, a retreat center where the dying and their loved ones can use psychedelics to help them all let go. Quote, if we limit psychedelics just to the patient, we're sticking with the old medical model, she said. This is exactly what I mean about metaphors and their entailments. As long as it's a client and a patient, we're stuck somewhere and something has to be denied. Quote, but psychedelics are so much more radical than that. I get nervous when people say they should only be prescribed by a doctor, unquote. Now that's a brilliant line because it's very conceivable that the following irony becomes the case. That at some point in the not very distant future, I can legally take a powerful psychedelic two ways. One, I go to a doctor who lets me take it in a clinic because he has a degree in psychotherapy, neuroscience, whatever. Or, on the other end of the scale, I can go to a priest or a shaman or someone who's attached to a church that is recognized as a religious entity by the state, and I can do that legally as well. But as a free-thinking freak, which in some ways I am and will always be, I cannot do either of those. That's very, very peculiar when you think about it from a certain angle, even though it makes total sense from another angle. And she's pointing out that deep and kind of problematic irony. She's also kind of making another point, which is the sort of hidden kind of Easter egg approach to the psychedelic renaissance, particularly around the matter of dying. Because obviously, these compounds are very good at, we've seen now very robust studies already, and there's many more that are being done, and there's going to be more coming down the pike, but they really work very well for end-of-life anxiety. Well, I mean, I don't know about you, but I do not, as far as I know, currently have a terminal disease. But I sometimes have end-of-life anxiety. Because, of course, we are all in the boat of mortality. And I'm not really sure after a certain point why you can say if you can take it, if you have a mortal disease, that's okay, but I can't, you know, prep, you know, like I want more advancement, you know. So I think of that as sort of a sneaky Easter egg, and I have a feeling that Michael Pollan thinks that too, and Catherine McLean certainly does. But what's interesting then is how he responds to this. So he says, in McLean's thinking, one hears echoes of the excitement of the 60s about the potential of psychedelics to help a wide range of people and the impatience with the cumbersome structures of medicine. It was precisely this exuberance about psychedelics and the frustration with the slow pace of science that helped fuel the backlash against them. So he goes on and he talks about sort of the ways in which we can think about it. But it's an interesting move because she has to, in the article, in this new story that he's creating, a powerful story, a wonderful story in many ways, somebody has to kind of carry the burden of the freak. Someone has to play the role of the one who still has these greater visions and who, like the free-thinking freak that I talked about initially, is so interested in human liberty that they find the kinds of strictures necessary for regulation, for neuroscience, for psychotherapy to, you know, intrinsically offensive. Because I think many of you would agree, I believe that I have the right to determine my relationship with these compounds on my own. And I do. And I think we all do. And that kind of libertarian element, I in many ways associate more with the freak legacy than with what we see emerging. And of course, the strongest example of this, and you know, MAPS is such the 800-pound gorilla in psychedelic discourse today that I almost don't want to talk about them just to sort of see what happens. But it's impossible not to. And one of the things that I talked about in my article is again an example of this question of discourse and multiplicity and this kind of kaleidoscope and what do we do with them? Because MAPS is in a very funny position. Since they're going for the mainstream, they're going for legitimacy, in addition to forcing you to go through a lot of hoops, to draw a lot of boundaries, to leave a lot of weirdness in the wake, it also costs a hell of a lot of money. So you gotta raise that money. And where are you getting the money from? Well, you're getting it from people like us, as well as other factors, but there's a way in which MAPS is in the ironic position of having to get funds from people whose values and experiences they also have to sweep under the carpet. And you can see this visibly in the topography of the recent psychedelic science conferences, where, let's just take the last one. So you have three tracks, right? You have a clinical track. So that's the clinic where we're in. And you have an interdisciplinary track, and then you have the ayahuasca track. And I will talk about the ayahuasca track in a moment. Putting that offside. So you have all this, but if you actually look at the interdisciplinary talk, that's what I'm talking about, right? That psychedelics are a profoundly interdisciplinary topic. They require, again, social science, anthropology, ethnography, history, religious studies, occultism, comparative mysticism, on and on and on and on. Hardly any of that makes an appearance in MAPS' construction of interdisciplinarity. Almost the whole track consists of further clinicians and psychotherapists. And not just in particular kinds of psychotherapists, mostly working on ego psychology, the sort of mainstream American, you know, kind of put the ego back together, get it working again, get on with it. And so it's profoundly disappointing. Now, the one mistake I made in the piece is kind of only harping on MAPS, and I found out afterwards that it's really the involvement of Hefter Institute that draws the strict line so that no crazies with, you know, purple suits and tales of UFOs are able to get on the stage. And again, it's completely understandable. Scientists need their reputation in terms of the way that their reputation is constructed as the world is. And I recognize that realism and that those lines have to be drawn in order for this new space to emerge. But what I'm troubled by is the lack, frankly, of awareness or criticism or sort of self-consciousness about that process and the individual decisions we all have to make about how we relate to that particular domain. So even at the same time as which you have, the electronic dance music and the crazy psychedelic art, and you got people in the halls who are like, you know, they have that wacky look, that little twinkle in the eye you remember from the Dead Show. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. At the same time, what you see on stage, i.e. what the discourse is, what the stories and images and ideas are that are organizing it, are very circumscribed. Very, very circumscribed. And again, that's part of where we're at. We're in this very complex process of multidimensionality, and there's no easy way out of it. But there's some very, kind of dangerous things about a pure psychopharmacological model, where we take these rich multidimensional compounds that are almost like agents in their own right, almost characters that we have to learn to deal with, and force them into the model of a pill. And even with the tremendous heart and amazing sensitivity of many of the therapists and researchers who are working on these things, there's some kind of distortion that enters into that field. One example of this, maybe it's not the perfect example, but I still think it's something that's indicative of some of this, is of course probably many of you are familiar with the extraordinary studies about the role of ketamine for clinical depression. So these are people who don't respond to any treatment whatsoever, and they show remarkable rates in relationship to reasonably high doses of ketamine. Reasonably high doses of ketamine. So there's a whole discourse, a whole world, a whole industry that is developing that wants to strip away the phenomenological, experiential dimension of ketamine, because it's seen that what is actually working is the drug as a pure effector, something that's operating below consciousness on the body directly. And that is really what's helping people with their depression, because, after all, depression is purely physical, whatever that means, purely neurological, whatever that means. And so these other effects are kind of like irritants that get in the, in the way. And it's amazing, I've read this stuff and you go like, oh man, you can't even consider the possibility that's precisely the phenomenology, precisely the dissolution, the expansion, the contact, the life, the shifts in memory, the cosmic dimensions that provide the opportunity for the system to reboot in a different way. And so for me, that's a kind of example of the way in which this new logic that's going to come in with its funding, with its pharmaceutical capitalism just waiting to take it in, and then that's the world we're in. It's a good thing in many ways, but it is a tricky thing. And I think if anything, the message of psychedelics is that the trickster is always in the room. You always have to, you got to let learn how to be a trickster, you got to recognize the signs of the trickster, and that kind of questioning, I think, is really imperative on us today as we make this move. Now, making this kind of argument, someone would say, hey, what are you talking about, man? I went to that MAPS conference, there's a whole track on ayahuasca. What are you talking about? Well, that's very interesting. Well, let's think about that a little bit. For one thing, of course, that's brought in by an outside character, and Bielabate, and again, it's a very interesting space because it is kind of multidimensional. The research that's going on in ayahuasca in Brazil, principally, but all over the world now, has a very rich range because ayahuasca, whatever else it is part of religion, part of religious formations, part of mestizo sects, part of indigenous traditions, and a whole variety of mixtures in between. So it's an obvious sociological object that you can study as a sociologist, as a psychologist, as an anthropologist, and there's a lot of this work that's being done. But that's not the reason that it's at MAPS. There's two main reasons that it's at MAPS. One is that unlike so many of the compounds that have been popular in the West until recently, ayahuasca carries with it a religious form. That's a phrase I prefer. And I'm not going to say it is religious, or that people who take ayahuasca are necessarily religious about their relationship to it, but the form that comes with it has a religious character. What do I mean by that? Well, it's interesting when you compare it to earlier experiences within Western psychedelic culture of ethnobotanical psychedelics that have some sort of religious or healing dimension to them. So, you know, people were taking peyote recreationally, you know, back in the early 20th century, and by the 1950s, you know, it was common in beatnik and underground scenes to, you know, truck down to Texas and buy a bunch of buttons and see what it's about. But the structures and forms of the Native American church did not come along with that usage. A little bit, tiny bit, but it really wasn't until the late 60s that hippies started to interact with the Native American church more robustly. Same thing with mushrooms. So even though everyone first heard about mushrooms by reading about the Mazatec Indians, and particularly in Gordon Wasson's view, the use of mushrooms there was a religious rite, even though in some ways it was probably had more to do with healing than with religion proper, because, you know, if you take Maria Sabina as an example, she was already deeply Catholic and saw these as sort of supporting a healing function rather than a mystical or religious rite in itself. But this was, of course, what people were interested in. So, you know, you have this kind of association, and yet it's not taken up by people in the West who start experimenting with psilocybin mushrooms very much. But with ayahuasca, it's like a package deal. And why that is a fascinating enigma that we can talk about. But the reality is that even when it's taken in a largely secular domain where the principal language is psychotherapeutic rather than shamanic or crypto-Christian, you know, syncretic Catholic, that even in those situations, the structure and the form and the relationship, intentions that people bring to those circles are, in my mind, essentially religious. So that's fascinating. But it also means that there's another route to legitimation, not just the secular psychotherapeutic route, where we're talking about individuals who can deal with their physical or psychological maladies, but that religion, which is, you know, has a certain cachet, in particularly in American society. So that one of the things about ayahuasca is that it actually shows that there can be this rich, multidimensional, spiritual experience of psychedelics, but that it has the legitimation that mushrooms and LSD do not have and will never have. Because who would want a religious relationship to LSD is a nightmare. I'll tell you some horror stories from the 70s if you want. So ayahuasca is playing this very interesting role. And yet, it brings with it some very interesting problems. And I don't want to talk too long. We're kind of winding up here. But I want to lay out two kind of questions, and then I'll make a final point. One is that what comes along with ayahuasca to the degree that a whole way of being and seeing the world can be said to be coming along with it to varying degrees, mixed up and reshaped along the way, is a profoundly, and I'm just going to call it, an animist worldview. And what does that mean? It means that the world is not only alive, that objects in the world are not only alive, but they're persons. And they're persons that we have relationships to, reciprocal relations of obligation. And these can be threatening others, and they can be bounteous others. And the degree to which the religion of ayahuasca, which of course is now, you know, a global fact, that it exists robustly in Europe, in America, and really in urban areas all over the planet, that to the degree that those experiences and the ideas and the practices that come along with that are communicating something from the indigenous and mestizo sources, what's being communicated is this relational view. But this relational view profoundly, profoundly challenges Western secular minds. Because the Western secular mind, the mind of the psychotherapist, the mind of the pharmacologist, of the clinician, fundamentally relies on that split between nature and culture. There's nature out there, things do things according to scientific laws, and there's a cultural human world in here that we experience, and we have language and, you know, things to sort of deal with. And what you're seeing in an animist model is that that model doesn't work. And once you let that model go, then you realize that you are part of a network with relations with all sorts of others, all sorts of outsides that are outside the human, and yet have a strangely relational quality to them. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens here. And as another example, my final example, of the kinds of tensions that emerge between these different discourses, again, I'm sure some of you are familiar with the, I guess you could call it a kind of kerfluffle over the Ethnobotanical Stewardship Council, which was established in 2013 along very MAPSE lines to act as a kind of, you know, NGO sort of service-oriented institution that would help facilitate the kind of safety and robustness of the ayahuasca tradition in South America as well as other places. Largely white, very much carrying the language of neoliberal politics, of shareholders and, you know, that sort of approach, you know, very much adopting this, the same kinds of language and models that run NGOs and that run MAPS in many ways, and bringing that to bear on the question of how do we make sure that people are safe? And in addition, perhaps help Native societies deal with the ravages of modernity or any number of effects. I have no doubt that these people are incredibly well-intentioned, and some of the stuff is going to happen whether you like it or not. Once you have a global ayahuasca market where people are going down there and people die and rapes happen, then you're going to have some kind of response on a legal, formal, you know, institutional level. It's going to happen one way or the other, and for good reasons. So I'm not talking about that, but what was very interesting to see what happened is that a whole bunch of scholars, mostly, you know, anthropologists and people working in the arena, just rose up with tremendous ferocity and exposed the naivete, the privilege, the closet imperialism of a lot of this language. I don't want to go into the details because they're complicated, and you know, I don't have an opinion about it ultimately. I'm not really sure who I would vote for. But I do believe that the people bringing up the problems are very accurate about a lot of the things that they say, and it indicates again one of these tension points between a sort of secular discourse of modernity, where individual rights and stakeholders, et cetera, and an other discourse that is not entirely modernized, that has within it not only traditions and entities, but it has within it witchcraft and sorcery. And the line that I just want to focus on before making my final point from the ESC's sort of list of the things that they wanted to do, help the, you know, make sure the ayahuasca wasn't depleted and help with safety, whatever, is to try to ensure a safe environment in which witchcraft and sorcery are kept at bay. Now, if you know anything about, you know, the anthropology of the Amazon basin, you know that sorcery and witchcraft are absolutely inextricably bound up with healing. Impossible to pull apart. Maybe in an individual, this guy doesn't do sorcery, this guy does, but as a cultural system, impossible. And that indeed, the world of animism, the world that people are opening up to through their experiences with ayahuasca, is one that I believe enforces upon you a recognition of these shades of gray, of the variety of forces that are out there and of the potential for sorcerous events. This is not in any way an attempt to justify rape or manipulation or murder and any of the kinds of things that can go along with dark side sorcery, but it's to acknowledge the incredible naivete of a Western model that wants to see this compound as being solely or predominantly an entity of healing without any shadow side. A shadow side that is not just about witchcraft or sorcery, but is about all the implications, all of the history of colonialism, of violence, of resentment, of tremendous suffering that is also coming through as people make this encounter. So it's an incredibly rich and marvelous and bizarre place that we're in. And I guess what my kind of final encouragement is for people to be aware in your own mind and when you're reading and talking about what kind of space you're in. What kind of discourse are you sort of playing with and where the boundaries are? What happens at those boundaries? Who gets othered and excluded? The witch, the hippie, you know, or the scientist with his all the rules and regulations. Who gets othered? And what happens at those juncture points? And can we see a way through to become supple and multidimensional and kaleidoscopic enough to be able to take in that those multiple dimensions, which are not just multiple dimensions of language or ways of seeing the world, but also, as ayahuasca teaches us, multiple dimensions of reality and relationships that we're embedded in and ain't gonna pull ourselves out, however much we quest in that free-thinking way that I have tremendous respect for and in some ways still think of myself as, that I associate with that freak refusal of structure and authority. So with that, I think I'll end, and I'm sure we're going to have an excellent discussion. Thank you. All right, maybe we get the lights? I'm going to take the cool chair now. So nifty. Yes, sir. Please say your name, too. That would be great. And I don't know, we're not going to try to record this, right?
No.
Okay, I will repeat the question.
And say yes, since it's the only mic.
My name is
influx of Eastern meditation practices and mysticism and
their own kind of magic. And of course, that's a major, major part of the whole 60s and the whole countercultural story that I didn't get into, and that has transformed and in remarkable ways today. I think the first thing that comes to mind is to say that perhaps in the same way that, you know, if you were going to say where does that actually start, you know, you're going to go all the way back into the 18th century, it's already the late 19th century, it's already like, you know, getting really in there, and different mutations happen, it's another huge spike in the 30s, another huge spike in the 50s. So it's been a long time coming. And then it may be the case that in 50 years, 75 years, that psychedelics will see something that doesn't look necessarily that different from the way we now think of, let's say, either mindfulness or yoga, both of which are extraordinarily mainstream, are barely religious, and perhaps in some ways aren't religious, because they've been so transformed by these various kind of cultural processes. But that's kind of what I think what's coming up for me now, and this is by no means the whole story, is that one difference is that if it's true, and it may not be true, but if it's true that part of what comes along with all of these stronger psychedelics, but certainly, let's just keep talking about ayahuasca, because ayahuasca, the point is that it comes along with a sort of, it's a package, cognitively, associationally, and in terms of the tradition, there's a kind of transmission there. The part of that is, has an even stronger magical, or I would say kind of person reality, where it's not just about, there's a way in which one can be very abstract about meditational states, satori, like achieve bliss, nirmanakaya, whatever, you can go on, and these things, and part of the reason that Eastern mysticism was made available or became available to the West was that it was stripped of its own kind of more mythological weirdness, that you didn't get popular Taoism. You got the refined philosophy of the Tao Te Ching or Zhuangzi. You didn't get all of the crazy magic around Vajrayana. Now, it did come through with the Vajrayana, so that you still have, you know, people who are deep in those practices are dealing with entities that have ferocious characters that are clearly related in some who knows why exactly way to the kinds of shadowy beings that can be experienced or heard about through ayahuasca experiences. But I still think that's kind of the minor effect compared to something like mindfulness or yoga, which is sort of precisely in their assimilable quality that makes them such a robust part of our world, but also a way in which the edge is dull, at least the critical edge in a lot of ways. They become ways to just assimilate, ways to deal with the stresses of postmodern life. That's all great stuff. I do yoga, I meditate, peace. But right, and that's a whole very interesting, very complicated story, and it's actually a good example of another kind of othering, which is that even though American Buddhism was deeply influenced by psychedelic experience in the 60s and 70s, almost all of the leaders in those days were deep experimenters, but if you go around today and you ask American Buddhist leaders what their opinion is about psychedelics, a lot of them are going to be very cagey. Perhaps that's changing now because the legitimation is changing what everyone can say about psychedelics. But 10 years ago, when I wrote an article about this, it was, you know, still kind of almost verboten. And in fact, I had actually I'd been at a Zen retreat, and I have a deep booming voice, and apparently you could hear what I was saying in Dokusan, and I was talking about my psychedelic experiences, and one of the sort of, you know, sub-muckety mucks came up to me and was like, oh, you know, you really want to keep it down in there, you know, it's like, I was talking about whatever, you know, like some horrible perversion or something. And it was an interesting kind of insight into the way in which, in order for American Buddhism to legitimate itself, it also has to kind of keep that stuff on hold, even though, as in Tantra, it's kind of a secret, something, well, you know, actually, they really go together well, you know. It's not something you're going to put on the front page. So that's a very Ely?
I agree very much about the multidimensionality of this gentleman over here. I have all sides of the sex drugs and rock and roll action, if you will, for one equivalency. But I think, you know, there's an interesting analogy that I see here in terms of, I don't know how you made this in regard to this, the scientists need the reputation. And I can see very much how on a certain level that's true. It helps them function more effectively in society and so on. But I see that, you know, we're doing the LGBTQ Center, and, you know, there's a lot, I think, of parallels to the LGBT movement. And, you know, the whole thing about coming out. But if you believe something, or you know you are something, and you keep that hidden, you don't talk about that, you know, it's not just saying, you know, it's not just affecting you. It's creating less space in society for people who are out. You know, if you're in the positive, it's like exercising a form of privilege. When it's about something that society is not openly dealing with or allowing people to be who they are. And so there's a cost to that that isn't sort of the cost on the flip side. Like, if people are having kids, it doesn't stop scientists from doing their work. But scientists doing their work, if they are exclusionary in that way, in the sense of not being out of the closet or acknowledging this other tradition over here, what have you, then they are imposing a cost on people trying to get into that tradition for being marginalized and criminalized.
Yeah, that was very, very wonderfully said, guys. No, in fact, just today I was reading an article. I'm not going to remember the name of the author, but it's in the latest Psychedelic Press journal, which is a really great journal if you guys are familiar out of the UK. It shows a different angle. There's a lot of people who aren't American writing for it. It's a cool little magazine. And the guy was actually making the point that, even taking that one step further, is that by scientists drawing that line so rigidly, right by them, like just in their own world, they also force all these people who are working kind of in between, like people who are hardcore social scientists, like people who are really doing their anthropology, they're really working it hard, but they have questions about how science functions in the modern world, and they all end up being pushed into the freaky zone. So it has damage not just against people who are taking the risk of coming out, but also just distorts the scientific process, even in their terms. That's the even in their terms, it distorts the process. Because science is part of culture, and those things operate. That's a very complicated issue, and for them to succeed in their work, it's still the kind of case that the cost is probably pretty high. And then just on your first point on sex, drugs, and rock and roll, another element about the underground, the freak, is my favorite way of thinking about it, because freak has a sort of edge of questioning, a sort of unwillingness to be taken. But there is a spirituality of hedonism, and it's both immediate and it's extremely deep. Because if you really want pleasure, if you really want to enjoy, it's a very complicated process. All sorts of things you thought were enjoyable aren't enjoyable, so then what do you do? Where does true enjoyment lead you? And so I believe that for some people, you know, there's a lot of places to fall off the path. There's a lot of traps. But that if you're legitimately following, as a thinking person as well as a being person, that the pursuit of enjoyment is going to bring you all the way there. Maybe other tools come along. And so I do really affirm that freak line with the questioning and with the embodiment and the hedonism as part of the whole philosophical worldview. And the fact that that has political implications precisely along the lines you're talking about with the LGBT closet as an example was really beautifully said. I really appreciate that.
Yes, sir? There's one point, and I think that within the psychedelic community, there's enough room that they can tent big enough for all four of the groups that you mentioned, and the recognition that they overlap a lot, and they can work and have all the ways to work
helps each other to get information from each of these groups that helps the other without harming each other. And it's true for a non-authoritarian legal structure, it's certainly going to exist in the psychedelic community somewhere. And I think that if you look at the long term, hundreds of years, that's going to be the most apt to survive because legal structures, by the definition, are subject to disappearance as soon as the politicians decide to do so.
Well, thank you for that optimistic vision. I think it's part of my stock in trade to emphasize, not so much conflict, but points of breaking, just as a way to kind of try to draw attention to conflicts, because there can be a tendency to not acknowledge the conflicts that are going on, even as part of the work of crafting a large tent. And so, this is all in service of this. This landscape is one landscape. Yes?
You spoke about yoga being mainstreamed, and I wanted to know what you thought about, I hear a lot of people talk about cultural appropriation, and what you think about that in relation to, especially white people taking medicines from indigenous people and bringing them back without the spiritual tradition, without religion, like how we can navigate that ethically as a society, especially as white people, we frequently are demonized for that, but being a witch, like that's part of what my tradition is taking from everything. So what could you say about that?
Yeah, that's a really, really complicated question in the sense that there is, for me, and I've thought a lot about this, like no easy answer at all. So it's sort of, unfortunately, I have nothing for you. I can reflect on that. And the reason is because they're both true. I mean, there's so many ways to talk about it in the sense that, on the one hand, some holders of tradition who are ethnic are happy and, exceedingly happy to share their wares. What do I make of that? Is that, do they have the right for that? Do they not have the right for that? That's just one beginning. Then there is the fact that some people across traditions are powerfully called in an unnameable, with unnameable force towards some particular, sometimes incredibly peculiar or exotic practice, place, tradition, that those resonances are so powerful that it doesn't matter, nothing's going to stop them. And that's real, that happens. And there are, scores of examples of situations where, for a variety of reasons, traditional holders of tradition, have no one else but to pass these things on to except Euro-Americans. I mentioned the example of peyote and the hippies, Native American Church and the hippies, where I know where there was a lot of interaction. It may have happened before, but I'm not sure very much. It was in the Taos Pueblo in the late 60s, where there was a guy named Little Joe. And he was pretty old, 80s, and nobody was interested in the Pueblo. Nobody. Except that it just happened that in northern New Mexico in the late 60s, there were a lot of searching freaks. And so he started to teach the ways to the freaks. And out of that came shifts in their practice that went on and influenced how hippies took psychedelics, and also some shifts, though to what degree I'm not sure, within some circles, at least making room for that kind of engagement. So I think the point that really stays with me, in fact I was thinking about this on the way over here, is that it has to do with relationships, particularly personal relationships. Is that I think that if people have a genuine call towards something where the issue of appropriation is really in your face, that it is upon you to attempt to seek out the kinds of relationships that would create an organic personal connection that would enable both the transmission and the mutation of tradition. And then people, if you don't do that, yeah?
One more question.
Okay. If you don't do that, then you're gonna have a price to pay. And then I have one final thing. I was actually at Pantheon on there this